Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the... Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, it's pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Lakers Lounge. I am your host, Harrison Fagan, filling in once again for Anthony Irwin. With the Lakers season in the books, I thought it would be a good time to touch base with one of my friends and mentors, Bleacher Report's Lakers beat writer Michael Pena. Mike wrote a really interesting article this week on the Kobe farewell tour and its effect on the Lakers franchise and the development of their young players, and so I wanted to chat a little bit about that with him. And we also got into the team's upcoming free agency efforts and its future outlook overall. So I hope you guys enjoy it, and here's our conversation. All right. Hey, Mike, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. We are just recording here on a Sunday. I guess the NBA playoffs are getting ready to start, and the Lakers are not a part of it. But I thought it would still be good to bring you in because I wanted to talk to you a little bit about you were there for Kobe's last game, I believe, right?
I was. It was one of the most unforgettable sporting experiences I've ever been a part of, I think.
Yeah, I wasn't there, but I you know, I've talked to a couple people, and it's like even watching it on TV, it was an event. It was something that, you know, I don't think that most people that watched it are going to forget anytime soon. And it felt like the most meaningful game the Lakers have played in probably like 5 or 6 years.
No, totally. And I mean, from the celebrities that were there to the former players to the video tributes that were just peppered throughout the entire game, I didn't even notice until the next morning that Derek Favors and Rudy Gobert didn't play, to be honest. It was like the Utah Jazz weren't even a team. And you kind of knew after the first like 2-3 minutes into the game, Kobe missed his first 5 shots, I think. And you just knew that you knew, first of all, that he was going to shoot, you know, every single time he touched the ball, as he should. But at that point, it was kind of like, is this going to be a 3-4-35 outing or is something special going to happen? And down the stretch, I mean, the fourth quarter was just not real life, and I was literally pinching myself, and it was – you can't really describe it, and just thinking about it sends chills down my spine, to be honest. And it's funny because it was such a meaningless game, and in the big picture. I mean, it was their 17th win of the season, and yeah, it was – meaningless for both teams, and yet it was going on simultaneously at the same time as the Golden State Warriors winning 73 games, and it turned that into a footnote, and it was just spectacular.
Yeah, I mean, it crashed Twitter in the first quarter. It took the Lakers' Twitter offline, and it's like you said, it was a completely meaningless game. The Lakers were locked into the second-best lottery odds. The Jazz had missed the playoffs already, and I'm pretty sure that their draft seeding was, if not locked in, just about locked in. And when you're that on the fringes of the playoffs, like a couple extra percent, like decimal points, don't make that much of a difference ultimately. And it was just kind of – it was magical. It was crazy. And like you said, the Jazz were almost like the Globetrotters out there. Nobody was really even paying attention to them. And so with all kind of those superlatives said, I get the sense from the article that you wrote, I believe it was the next day for Bleacher Report in one of your many writing jobs. And this one, you know, you're on the beat with the team for the Lakers. But I get the sense that you definitely don't think that one game was worth kind of everything that preceded it. So for those of our listeners that haven't read your article, can you kind of take us into your thought process on Kobe in the last couple of years?
Sure. I mean, from the day he signed his 2-year, $48.5 million contract extension in 2014, at the time, just as a general NBA observer, I was not covering the team in 2014, but you just knew that that was a terrible, terrible thing. And this was also before the salary, we knew the salary cap was going to rise and all that, but to allocate that much money to a player who was clearly declining, coming into, you know, obviously the end of his career, that it was speculated at the time that the 2 years would be his last 2 years in the league. And you just can't really, you can't do that when you're really, the way that you are improving your team is through free agency. That's how the Lakers like to do things. And it kind of got to the point where, I mean, they obviously struck out in free agency the past two off seasons, and Kobe kind of sucked up a lot of their resources. And this past year, it kind of leads us into this past year with his farewell tour, which was, you know, it was comical at times. I would say most of the time it was pretty much like a circus, and it wasn't real. It wasn't really basketball a lot of the time, and I don't think any other organization with foresight would do the things that the Lakers did this year. I totally understand the business side of it. I understand loyalty, and I understand just what he meant to that organization. But at the same time, to basically allow him to do as he pleases, to hijack the offense, not play defense, and have the team suffer, have the young players relatively suffer, it's just, it's not worth it.
Yeah, and I thought that that was kind of the biggest point, less so than the Lakers not being competitive because of his salary, because they probably, even if they didn't sign him, they may not have been that competitive anyway. We don't know how they would have been able to spend that money or those dollars in free agency. They may not have been much better than this. But because of the whole circus around the farewell tour, you know, the young guy's development was stunted a little bit. Kobe had a higher usage rate than, you know, you made the point. He had a higher usage rate than his career average in a year when he was one of the least efficient players in the league. And it's kind of as much as I'm sure that this wasn't his intention to stunt the growth of the young guys, but, you know, it can't help but affect, you know, their growth and development moving forward, and the Lakers evaluation process of what they have on their hands with these guys.
Right. And I mean, you threw out the usage percentage numbers and they were startling. I think he was ninth highest in the league. He could have been higher at, no, I'm sorry. I think he was fourth or fifth highest in the league.
He was fourth. I have it right here. He was behind only James Harden, DeMarcus Cousins, and Steph Curry.
Right. And those are the type of players that should be having high usage percentages with their teams. They're in their primes or nearing their primes, and they're fantastic offensive players. Kobe is not that right now. He shot 36% from the floor this year, and you know, he wasn't really good. And when you have players like Jordan Clarkson and D'Angelo Russell and Julius Randle, players who you would really like to see them, A, play together as much as possible, and Kobe talked a little bit about that in his post-game press conference after his final game. But you also want them to be playing within an offense that kind of makes sense, and the Lakers were so ISO-heavy, and I don't want to put all that on Kobe, because obviously it's not 100% his fault, but when he's so ISO-heavy, I think that bleeds a little bit into kind of what the other guys do. And Julius Randle's ISO numbers were really gross. I don't think he's an ISO player. I don't think he'll maximize his abilities as an ISO player in the NBA. And just giving Clarkson and giving Russell the touches that they need to develop, the ball was in Kobe's hands when he was on the floor with those guys a lot, and that's troublesome.
Yeah, and then, so how much of that isolation do you get the sense, because like you said, it was team-wide, how much of that do you get the sense is kind of the behind, like that was their coaching philosophy and that was kind of what they wanted to get, those were the looks they wanted to get for those guys, and how much of that is just them kind of, that's the play style that they've probably always played? Like, I would imagine Julius Randle throughout his, I mean, I can't claim to have watched a bunch of Julius Randle in high school, but I watched a bit of him at Kentucky and I watched him this year. I would imagine isolation is probably where he spent the majority of his time before this. And so he had to adjust to the NBA. And so how much of that, so how much of his isolating and the rest of the guys, do you get the sense is kind of the looks that the Lakers were looking for, and how much of that is just the way that they wanted to play?
Well, Byron Scott spent a majority of the season talking about how he wanted the team to move the ball more. And throughout the season, there was, you could call it improvement, but when you're starting at such a low point, I don't, it's relative improvement, but it's not meaningful. And for all the young guys, from Russell to Clarkson and Randle, you know, Scott would talk about their youth as a factor and their inability to comprehend offensive and defensive principles that he was trying to implement. And, you know, that's obviously not popular with Lakers fans and observers of the team. But you kind of get where Scott's coming from with the amount of youth on board and the players, the veterans who were brought in, Lou Williams most notably, who was an ISO specialist himself. It was really tough, and it was a battle to move the ball all season long. And there was a storyline. I can't remember when exactly. I believe it was shortly after the All-Star break, maybe before, where you know, they implemented this set, and that was a big narrative.
Yeah, that they beat the Warriors with it. It's the Warriors killer.
Right. Yeah. Totally. That's exactly what happened. And that's kind of. That was, you know, that I don't know if that means anything, but it was a nice narrative for Scott to kind of publicly talk about what he wants to see, because the ISO heavy basketball that they played all season was gross and it was ineffective, and their offense was one of the worst in the league throughout the entire season. So it's tough. I think it's a part of their I think youth is a factor. And I don't know if another coach could have taught them better. I don't know if another coach could have implemented a more ball movement heavy system or philosophy. But Scott didn't, and whether or not that's his fault is up for debate. But the fact is that their offense was ISO heavy and it was terrible.
Yeah, it was really, really rough to watch a lot of times this year. And then that just, it makes it so much easier on the defense, because they know if a guy, you know, like a guy like Lou Williams is not necessarily going to pass. They know Kobe is going to get his 25 shots up. You know, they know the rest of the guys almost are, and, you know, like Jordan Clarkson, seems like he prefers the ISO, or he was definitely a little bit of a black hole this year. Julius Randle catching the ball at the elbow and just kind of hanging out there for, you know, 5 seconds on the shot clock, deciding before he ends up driving into traffic. Those were all kind of major issues with the Lakers this season. But getting back to the young guys and kind of Kobe's farewell tour, another interesting point that I thought that you made was how they barely got to play together. At time, there was one point in the year where they were averaging about 13.5 minutes a game together, And I don't know that it ended up, did it end the season like that? Was that their season ending average? I don't remember.
It's the first month versus post. The first month was about 15 minutes per game for those guys, for those three, the core three. And then the second number I calculated was just after he announced that he was going on his farewell tour. And it was down to, I think, 13.5, 6, 7, something like that.
Yeah, and so that's obviously, again, that's something that's not ideal, because if you're the Lakers, what you're trying to do this season is, you know, I mean, Kobe to some degree deserves fanfare on his way out. But really what the purpose of this season from a basketball perspective should have been was kind of evaluating those young guys going forward and their fit together on the roster, because it isn't necessarily perfect. You know, as we talked about, there are like a couple guys that really like to have the ball in their hands and isolate. And so I guess I'm curious for your opinion on how you think, given what we saw this year, that they fit together moving forward, you know, even though it's obviously a small sample size that we actually got to watch them together.
Yeah, it's tough. I should say before I answer your question that the number one trio in minutes played, or the number one threesome, was Randall Clarkson and Russell. So they played a lot together, but my point generally was just that they could have played a lot more, and that's kind of the whole the strategy this season should have been to play them as much as possible, and they didn't do that. But to answer your question, can they fit long term? It's tough to say, to be honest, because you don't know what Clarkson's going to be. You don't know, or should I say, you don't know if Clarkson can be a full time starter. And it didn't look like that's from his defensive issues to. You talked about his him being a black hole, which is definitely the case. To me, he's kind of like a young, less effective Monte Ellis, to be honest. He just reminded me of Monte Ellis's game all season long, and we know the type of career that Monte had. It was Clarkson can shoot threes better, and he's more willing to fire away from the outside, which is a good sign, but other aspects of his game really reminded me of Monte, and you know, coming off the bench might be a better future for Clarkson, and that's okay, that's perfectly fine. Randall really struggled in a lot of different areas this season. His jump shot was non-existent. He struggled attacking longer players in the paint. He improved that part of his game as the year went on, but early on it was a real, real struggle. And then his defense was pretty bad all year.
I think you could say that. I don't even know that we have to add that caveat anymore at this point. I think
that's
that
very
pretty
fair.
Much you could just say that about any Laker.
Very, very fair. His rebounding, though, was top-notch. He was one of the best defensive rebounders in the entire league when you look at his rebound rate. And that's really important. Early in the year when those numbers started to pop up, I wondered if they were empty calories, if they even mattered on a team that jacks up so many shots and, you know, a team that's not good. When your box score numbers are impressive, it's meaningless.
How much of that rebounding do you think, because Hibbert kind of has always had a reputation as a guy that he'll box out, he doesn't get a lot of rebounds, but his teams generally do well on the boards because he's keeping his guy off of the boards. I remember that being kind of a major narrative in Indiana. Do you feel what, how much of Randall's rebounding do you feel like was a product of that, of just playing alongside a big that wasn't necessarily going to get a ton of rebounds?
I don't want to give Hibbert really any credit for Randall's success, to be honest. I think Randall's a very good rebounder. And he reminds me a lot of Tristan Thompson, of Kenneth Faried, those type of guys. If I had to compare him with anyone in the league right now, kind of players who struggle to create their own shot and score efficiently, but also without range, but who really impact games on the glass and have to be accounted for. So that's fine. And if he's one of those guys, I don't think that it's the end of the world, to be honest. I think if he's consistently a top five rebounder, that's fantastic. That's something you can hang his hat on and have a long, productive NBA career. I think where he was drafted, I think that Laker fans probably want more out of him. And to do that, he'll need – I mean, that, I just think the jump shot is absolutely crucial, and I think defense is crucial because his – I think his ability to make plays on the open floor is a bright spot. His passing can improve. He's shown signs and a willingness to move the ball a little bit when the opportunity presents itself.
Yeah, I thought he got a lot better at that in the last couple weeks.
For sure, definitely. But his, you know, the jump shot is key. It's absolutely crucial for him to take the step to the next level and to get back to how he plays beside the backcourt. You really need to space the floor if you're big in today's NBA. So I don't know if he can really help those guys if he can't shoot.
So you've made the point about Clarkson. He might be better going to the bench. Is that something that you guess that you get the sense that he'd be amenable to going forward? Because he's going to be a free agent this summer, and all indications, it looks like the Lakers are going to keep him. It wouldn't make any sense to let him walk for nothing. They can match any offer he's given. But do you feel like moving forward, if he's going to be better on the bench, do you think that that's something that he's going to be accepting of after being kind of a starter and being one of the few bright spots and being grouped in with this young core the last couple of years?
I think that I can't speak for him. I think that winning and team success kind of trumps everything when it comes to individual roles and shots and things like that. And if the Lakers win twice as many games and are banging on the eighth seed next season and he's coming off the bench and still contributing, I think he'll be fine. But I think it also matters on what type of offseason they have, what position player they get in the draft, if they keep their pick, who they sign in free agency, that sort of thing. So I think if you move him to the bench and you just start Lou Williams or something at the two, I don't think that's going to work, to be honest.
Yeah.
But if it makes sense and it improves the team, then, I mean, you would like to think he would be okay with it.
Yeah. And then so kind of getting into that off-season stuff a little bit, you know, you talked about the importance of the Lakers keeping their pick and that kind of thing. But so, and then also talking about the Kobe farewell tour, how many years, given, especially if they keep their pick, how many years do you feel like the franchise was possibly set back by something like this going on? Because I thought that, you know, the premise of the article was that from a basketball standpoint, this Kobe Bryant farewell tour wasn't the greatest thing for them. But his veteran leadership, I thought you made the excellent point. His veteran leadership did have value this season. But aside from that, he didn't add a whole lot to the franchise moving forward. So I guess I'm curious for your thoughts on, you know, how many years he set them back, or this whole process set them back, because again, it's not all on Kobe. Part of that's on the organization and sentimentality and that kind of stuff, and somewhat justified sentimentality. But where do you see the team going forward, like going into next year, going into the next couple years?
Well, you know, I talked to a lot of the young players on the team about Kobe for that article. And, I mean, I knew heading in that my premise was going to be skewed negative. But I talked to them about what he meant and what it was like playing with someone who took so many shots when, you know, the shots weren't going in on most nights. And basically all of them were incredibly positive about Kobe and about the type of impact he had on them off the court and the type of work ethic that he instilled and he put on display, and his expectations for them and how much work it really takes to improve your game at this level. So I think for all the you can blame the front office, to be honest, and you can blame the coaching staff just as much as you can blame Kobe. And I think that it's a little unfair to say that he or blame him for the X number of years that set the franchise back, because as a player, I mean, why wouldn't he take that money? Why wouldn't he take shots that are afforded to him by a coaching staff that is unwilling to take them away? That's his job. That's what he's supposed to do. So I don't really know how many years it set them back. I think that this off season is critical. More so, I mean, the draft pick is obviously a big deal. Although if they get it this year, they have to give it up next year. I think is it top three protected?
It's top three protected again next year. And then the following year, it's unprotected. But that would mean that the Magic get 2 second round picks instead of the first rounder that the Lakers also owe them.
Correct. So you want to keep the pick this year, no doubt about it. And free agency is obviously critical. Again, they've struck out the past two off seasons. And it'll be very interesting to see if they shoot for the stars again, or if they kind of behave like every other team and are more open to hunting for value on the open market, because this summer's free agency crop is not great. It's not terrible. It's not great either, though. And the stars, the superstars, the franchise altering players, I don't think any of them are really going to look hard at Los Angeles. So yeah, I think there's a real uphill climb here for this organization.
What do you think is their biggest need positionally going forward? Well, actually, before we get into that, that was kind of why I liked your article. Going back to the Kobe thing, that was why I liked your article, and I thought it was well-reasoned, was that you didn't entirely pin that blame for the Kobe farewell tour on Kobe. Because he wrote kind of the farewell to basketball. He did the big process of that. And, you know, it was clear that part of that was trying to distract from how poorly he was playing right now. It shifted the narrative a little bit. But, you know, just as much as on him, you know, if somebody offers you $48.5 million, it's hard to turn that down. And, you know, if you look at Dirk and the Mavericks, it's not even a guarantee that if you take less money that you can get a team that's going to contend for titles and that kind of stuff put around with you. Because, you know, in the first round this year, they're going to get whacked by the Warriors. Now, again, you can make the argument using Tim Duncan took less money, and that's turned out a lot better for him. But it kind of, you know, it turns out if you don't play for the Spurs and their organization, that taking less money may not actually lead you to a tremendously more competitive roster. Although Dallas, again, was a lot better than the Lakers this year. It's just they're going to get waxed in the first round, and it ultimately won't matter a whole lot. But then kind of going into free agency, now that that whole process is over, going into free agency this year, what do you think are the Lakers' biggest needs?
Everything. I think that their roster is seriously lacking talent. You would like to start at the top, maybe. Center is a huge need, but league-wide and where the league is going, that position isn't as important as it used to be. So spending big money on a center may not be the best use of their resources, but they need one because Roy Hibbert is not that guy. And the wing,
you see, on the Hibbert thing, Do you see any chance that they bring him back? There's no way, right? After the way that this year went, I know that both sides have kind of said the right things, but there's no way, right?
I would be shocked. Yeah, I don't even really know after the type of season he had, and just the way the league is going. I don't know how he's on the court longer than 15 minutes a night for a good team. If that.
Yeah.
So he can't defend pick and rolls. And I mean, they pick and rolled him to death every opponent this season. And
yeah.
I mean, guards today can pull up and they can knock down open 18 footers. They can pull up behind the 3-point line and he's not venturing out there. So I don't know what his role is in the NBA to say what his role is with the Lakers. But moving on from Hibbert, I think that they need help on the wing and they need a defender. They need a lockdown defender. They need 3-and-D help. They need a superstar, to be frank. And I mean, obviously a guy like Kevin Durant would be a wonderful fit. He'd be a wonderful fit on just about any team. I don't think I don't think he's going there. Beyond him, you have, you know, your DeMar DeRozans, your Chandler Parsons, your Nikola Batums. I think these guys are interesting players. I don't think any of them are super duper stars and even all stars in the Western Conference next season. But those are the types of players that, you know, the Lakers need to really look at, because they need to piece by piece improve the talent level on this team. And I don't know if you're a championship contender if your core is Russell, Randall, Clarkson, and Ben Simmons, to be frank. I don't know if that's going to be good enough to grow into something special. So I really think that they need to start spending in free agency, spending wisely in free agency, and getting players who are still improving in their career and who can really help on both ends of the floor.
Yeah, do you – on that note, I agree with you. I think the wing is probably the more important area of need going forward, just because of the way that their roster is currently constructed and where they have kind of their very limited talent right now. But do you see them going after it, changing their stance on going after kind of these restricted free – because in the past, they've never wanted to go after restricted free agents. But do you see them would you see value in putting in an offer on a guy like Harrison Barnes or someone like that that's restricted and just kind of challenging their team to match earlier in free agency?
No, not really, to be honest. Nothing against Barnes. I don't think that, you know, I think to get him away, it's going to cost a max deal or something close to it.
I mean, and it seems like the way that the cap's going, it's going to cost a max deal for almost anyone this summer. It's insane.
Right, and I don't think it's wise to throw Barnes and the expectations that would come with a max deal for the Los Angeles Lakers the year after Kobe retired. The expectations for Barnes would be through the roof. And, I mean, he's a fifth option right now. He plays for a 73-win team, and he's a wonderful fit on that team for what he brings. His versatility, his ability to knock down open threes, his ability to create his own shot, his ability to guard up and down a position for meaningful stretches. That's all very valuable, but as the number one guy, which he would presumably be if he signed with the Lakers – next season and in the years to come, I don't see that happening. I think he'll leave Golden State, but I just don't think that going into a team where contextually he's the number one option would be wise for him. So the other options, I guess, are, you know, there's guys like I think Bradley Beal might be a more interesting restricted free agent option, especially considering if you throw a max his way, I mean, it's risky because of his injury history, but then you don't really know what the Wizards are thinking right now, and they're in turmoil. They just had a terrible season, and if they are they still on the incline? Are they on the verge of blowing things up? What, I don't know where they're at. So that might be worth it just to shake things up, but, you know, restricted free agency is really difficult, and I would stick, if I were the Lakers, I would stick to heavily recruiting guys like Parsons and Batum, who are both in situations that they aren't want to leave. So it's difficult. It's very difficult.
Yeah. Well, out of those two guys, which one do you think would be the better fit for the roster going forward? You'd almost lean Parsons just because he's a little, I believe he's a little younger, but he's had his injury history and stuff. And then kind of Batum has played well above, you know, his prior career, you know, in a contract year.
I get what you're saying. Totally. I like Parsons a lot. His knee really, it worries me, to be honest. Knee surgery isn't great. But he has size, he can shoot threes, he makes his teammates better on offense. The reason I like Batum more is he's only 27, he plays both ends. And if
that's
you look
younger
at,
than I thought. Okay.
Yeah, he's not old. He's just been in the league a really long time.
Okay.
But he's kind of like a Swiss Army knife who he makes teammates better. He can create his own shot, he can shoot threes himself. And if you look at what he did for that Hornets team this season, and what his impact had on Kemba Walker specifically, I think the world of Batum. I think he deserves that the max deal he's getting from whoever gives it to him. But you know, if the Hornets go on a little run here, which I personally love the Hornets, and I think that they're totally capable of winning multiple series this season. You know, he's not leaving, so it's going to be very tricky for them to add a meaningful player, even though that's kind of what they need to do.
Yeah, it's one of those situations where they have the most cap room in the league, and they trumpet that, and kind of a lot of it seems like the local media is kind of trumpeting that, but everybody has cap room this summer. And so you can't just have that. You have to be able to have other stuff on your roster that makes yourself appealing to free agents. And, you know, the Lakers have some promising young guys, but it's not necessarily the most, you know, attractive destination for a guy like a Batum that's, you know, 20, even though he's 27, I get that's not, I thought he was 29 for some reason, but still at 27, you're looking to kind of go into a competitive environment rather than wait around for the development of kids. And then speaking of those kids, you kind of have the locker room, all the locker room stuff that happened this year with the D'Angelo Russell video leaking and, you know, the reports of discord stemming from that. And then there were some people that were kind of saying that that was going to be this huge blight on the Lakers going forward, recruiting players in free agency because players weren't going to want to play with him. Do you buy into that?
You know, I think that culture is incredibly important for every team in the league. And I don't think that – I think in the big picture, I think this one incident isn't a deal breaker for players to come to the Lakers and play with Russell. I don't think that. But I do think that the fact that it happened is indicative of a problem with the Lakers culture and their lack thereof. Their environment, it's just not, I mean, it's not conducive. Obviously the talent level is low, but I mean, those guys, you know, there's just so many problems with that organization. And this is slightly off topic, but going back to Kobe and the contract he signed compared to the contracts that Duncan and Dirk signed, those guys took less money because they trust their front offices. They trust those organizations to take the money that they would have had and put pieces around them to be in winning situations. And both those front offices came through for them in big ways. The Dallas Mavericks, you know, they've had bad luck, I think, more than anything. You talked about
that. Yeah, that's right. I mean, the DeAndre Jordan thing, they had him locked in, and they would have I think they would have been more competitive this year if that whole situation hadn't happened. So that's a fair point.
Sure, there's Jordan, but then there's also, you know, injury luck. And
yeah.
Parsons, and for them to make the playoffs this year when I thought that they were going to have a bottom five defense, I mean, it's incredible. It's one of the better stories in the whole league, and Dirk knew that heading in, or he wouldn't have signed that deal. Duncan sure as hell knows that he's going to the playoffs, and he's going to be on a title contender if he takes less money,
yeah,
because he trusts Greg Popovich, and he trusts R.C. Buford. I don't know if Kobe, you know, I don't think Kobe necessarily has a lot of trust in the Lakers front office. And frankly, I don't think that they've given him a great reason to, with the discord in ownership on down to just kind of their inability to court free agents over the last couple summers, even with his big contract on the books. I mean, their inability to they totally butchered the meeting, their first meeting with LaMarcus Aldridge. That's not news to anybody. And so I think trust and with Kobe in the front office is meaningful. And it kind of shows you just what type of organization, what type of franchise this is right now. And they don't have culture, and culture is important. And I think that is more important than one little, I mean, it's not little because he probably ended a relationship, but what D'Angelo Russell did with Nick Young.
No, I think that's a really interesting point about trusting in the front office and whether or not he's had reason to. And then you talked about the Mavericks kind of having bad luck. You don't feel like the Lakers have had a little bit of bad luck of their own with some of their moves that kind of, you know, they set up and they looked good at the time and just haven't went through? Because, you know, they had the CP3 trade a couple years ago, which was really solid, although I guess, you know, that ended up getting vetoed for reasons out of their control. And then the Nash and Dwight Howard stuff, like sign and trade for Nash, trade for Dwight Howard, those both looked really good at the time and ended up kind of falling apart because of injuries or personal conflicts and that kind of thing. But going into Kobe getting his extension, they were just coming off of that year with Nash and Dwight. And so you don't feel like maybe they were victims of bad luck as well a little bit. And maybe, you know, there was at least some reason at that point to trust the front office.
Yeah, sure. Those are fair points. They've had their fair share of bad luck too. But I think that they've also created their own bit of bad luck. I think that, you know, acquiring Dwight and then playing him from, you know, he played right away, right off back surgery, when reports at the time were kind of like, you know, I don't know if this guy should be playing basketball right now. And Steve Nash was coming off a pretty good year with Phoenix, and that was a wise complimentary piece to throw in with Kobe and Dwight and Powell. He was also extremely old, and you know, his body could break down at any moment, especially outside the confines of the Phoenix Suns training staff.
Yeah, so, I think at this point we've learned that they have some type of magical powers at the very least.
Sure, definitely. I agree. But then, like, just this year, I mean, they signed Lou Williams, and that's a value deal. But at the same time, why are you doing that? Why are you signing Nick Young? Why are you bringing in why are you trading for Roy Hibbert? Why are you signing Brandon Bass? And there was very little risk in those last two moves. But if you're really, you know, it just didn't make a lot of sense to kind of mismatch the roster with so many veterans that are better suited to be complementary pieces in win now situations, instead of, you know, mining the D League and looking at players who, I mean, you look at the Memphis Grizzlies and the players that they've added to their team that have contributed in light of all their injuries, and they're still in the playoffs. And you just look at that and you wonder, would the Lakers have been able to scout and find that type of talent at the bottom of the barrel? And I don't know if they would have been able to. And that stuff's really important.
Yeah, so that talent evaluation stuff and the way that the front office looks from the outside is that is important to players, that they sense that, you know, that this team, if they sign with them, is going to be able to add the right pieces around them, or is signing them to a situation where they're going to fit in and be able to maximize their own value. But, and so I guess that will weigh on the minds of free agents this summer. But the other thing too, that I thought that you brought up that was interesting, was kind of the ownership situation and the weirdness there with the Jim Buss deadline coming up next summer to supposedly get them back to the Western Conference Finals. Now, I don't think that I'm going out on a limb by saying that that's not going to happen, but do you feel like that kind of deadline is also going to be something that affects the minds of free agents going forward? Because I mean, in my mind, it's like, how could it not? Because the guy that's bringing me in might not be here in a year.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely matters. I think a lot of people don't really, or don't realize how important stable ownership is and being on firm ground from the top down. And the Lakers aren't really, they're not in that situation right now. And it's costly for sure. Ultimatums and these deadlines, and I don't know if they're healthy for the organization, and it doesn't seem to be the most communication. So yeah, that's a problem, and it might be an even bigger one than we know or realize from the outside looking in.
Yeah, so I mean, this definitely was not a glowing review of their situation going forward. This got pretty dark. So, for I want to end kind of on a positive note. So,
is that possible? Just for,
huh?
Is that possible?
I mean, we're gonna try. So, what do you think going forward for the team? What do you think is something that fans can kind of look at and draw a little bit of hope from? Because, you know, we've spent the last 30 minutes kind of explaining everything wrong with this team, both the past year and going forward. And so I think that while I think that that's a needed dose of reality for a lot of people, I just, you know, I want to give our listeners a little bit of something positive to end on. So what do you feel like is the most promising kind of aspect of the organization going forward?
I think that the fact that they're the Los Angeles Lakers, and that's their name and that's their brand, and that's their fan base is incredibly loyal. And, you know, this season, I'll never forget one of the most most memorable games this year for me was New Year's Day. They were playing the Sixers, and Kobe did not play. And it was announced, I think, shortly before opening tip or earlier in the day. I can't remember, that Kobe wasn't going to play.
Yeah, I remember. And it was the day. I don't remember exactly when on that day, but yeah.
Right. And the crowd that night was freaking delirious. And, you know, like, I don't think – I've been to quite a few NBA arenas, and I could not imagine. I mean, these are the two worst teams in the league, playing the crappiest basketball, and the fans are like losing it for every single time something positive happened for the Lakers. And it was like that throughout the entire season, regardless of their record, regardless of drama that was going on, minus a few boos for D'Angelo Russell when it was the height of that drama.
That was a bizarre night.
It was very bizarre. But outside that, the crowd has really supported this team. And, you know, that affects, I think, guys like Russell Westbrook, who was, you know, whenever he came to LA this year, he would talk about playing at home, playing at the Staples Center, playing against the Lakers in that arena with all the celebrities, and just kind of how that environment is different from just about any other place in the league. And so I think that the Lakers have very simple things to sell free agents. I don't know if it'll work at all, but I think a guy, honestly, I think a guy like Westbrook, if Durant leaves this summer, I mean, he's out the door the following summer, and that's a guy who can really turn your franchise around in 2 seconds. So I think the Lakers still have, I think you can't count them out no matter how bad it looks, just because they are the Lakers. And yeah, I think that free agency is always, they're always one signing away from turning it around. And when that happens, their next era of prosperity will begin.
Okay, well, that's at least, you know, at least all hope is not lost, because the prior 30 minutes of that, of this, for anyone that stuck around with us, you know, I do apologize for kind of crapping on your dreams a little bit, but it's, you know, it's stuff that kind of needed to be discussed and said. And so, Mike, I really appreciate you coming on, and you know, we can find your writing at, I believe, Bleacher Report, Sports on Earth, Real GM, Fox Sports. Where did I miss anything?
That's about it for now. Yeah.
Okay. Well, so thank you very much for coming on. Do you have anything that you want to plug as we're heading out here?
No, I'm just going to be, I'm covering the Clippers Trailblazers series. And if the Clippers advance, I'll be covering their series against the Golden State Warriors in the second round. I feel safe enough to say that already. So yeah, I'll be covering that for Bleacher Report, covering the Clippers for Bleacher Report from here on out. So I know that the Lakers fans are really excited to read my work on the Clippers in their pursuit of a title.
Yeah, I'm sure, that's definitely something I think most Lakers fans are really psyched about, is the Clippers this year, for sure.
Of course, as they should be.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks again for joining me today, Mike. This was fun. We're going to have to bring you back in free agency.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Big thanks again to Mike for joining me today. Be sure to follow him on Twitter at Michael V. Pena, and you can follow me at HM Fagan. Thanks again for everyone listening, and we'll catch you next time.